It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host. Welcome to a podcast where we talk about really, really old movies for fun and profit. Today's movie is Hot Saturday from 1932. We'll be talking about that shortly, but we can't do that until I give you a little old movie news. Today, all we have for you are Blu-rays. There are several individual Blu-rays and one collection, the Vincent Price collection from Scream Factory. I think that's also Shout Factory, but the horror imprint is Scream Factory, I guess. And you get six movies in this collection, including The Pit and the Pendulum, The Fall of the House of Usher, The Haunted Palace. These are from Price's sort of mid to late career where he was doing a lot of horror movies. And I say that, it might surprise you, because Price was not primarily a horror actor when he started out, and in the 40s and even in the 50s, he was playing a lot of very interesting parts that did not scare the crap out of people. Also released recently, The Bitter Tea of General Yen. This is an early 30s Barbara Stanwyck movie, and I will warn you that there is a bit of a yellow face happening here. You can't deal with Asian storylines in early 30s movies without, unfortunately, some of that. I will say that Stanwyck is very good, and yeah, don't drink the tea. Just don't drink it. And also, don't cross Barbara Stanwyck. The last two are sort of minor sort of comedies, fluffy comedies from 50s, 60s, that era. One called The Art of Love with Ethel Merman and Never Steal Anything Small with James Cagney and Shirley Jones. Just a little tip for those of you who follow the show. Often in the news section, I choose to present things in the order of interest to me personally. As it happens, this is also the order they were in on the page that I was reading today. But if you ever want to know whether I think a movie like Never Steal Anything Small is as good as the Vincent Price collection, look no further than the order of play. Well, that's it for the news. Now it's time to get on to the main attraction of the day, Hot Saturday from 1932. But I can't start talking about that movie until I introduce my wonderful guests for today. Returning once again is Erica Ensign. Hello.
Hello. I am happy to be back, and this time watching a movie I'd never seen before.
That's what we strive for, to find movies you haven't seen and make you watch them. Next up, Nathan Alderman, also returning. Nathan, I want to know where it is in my house you're hiding today.
Oh, I'm in your walk-in closet, Shelley, rifling through your clothes to see which ones I want to, quote-unquote, borrow.
I'm not surprised by that at all. And making his first appearance on the show, it's Adam Roach. Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me. It's very exciting.
It's very exciting for us to have you as well. And Adam, because you're new to the show and folks might not be familiar with your work, tell us about a couple of podcasts that you do, at least one of which has very direct bearing on the movie we're going to talk about today.
So I originally began hosting Attaboy Clarence in 2014, which is devoted to the golden age of Hollywood and the people that made it happen, and old time radio, which is my other huge passion. So I try to present, you know, a couple of reviews every week and a trip down memory lane and then a radio play for people to enjoy. And since 2015, I've been producing The Secret History of Hollywood, which is more of a long form biopic kind of show. It's, you know, I take a person or a subject and go deep and produce very long shows. They're known for being very long. Yes. My latest series is about Cary Grant, which is I think why I'm here. So hi.
And you've talked about Alfred Hitchcock and Val Lewton and James Cagney, all sorts of, and they're epics. They really are. I mean, I was expecting the first part of the Cary Grant episode to be, you know, 3 or 4 hours, but I did a double take when it came into my podcatcher, and it was 12 hours.
I think a lot of people
hours.
Did. It's 12 hours.
12 hours, wow. Adam.
Yeah, it's one episode, it's 12 hours. And I don't mean for them to be so long. It's just that I know where I'm starting and I know where I want to finish. So I tried to get there as quickly as possible. It's just this one had a lot to do. So, it's a very different show to the ones I've made before.
And you've just gotten us to, what, 1934 at the end of the first?
30 years in 12 hours. It's crazy because I did
for a life.
I know, right? So I did The Life of Alfred Hitchcock completely from boyhood to death in 20 hours. I did the complete story of the Warner Brothers and James Cagney and, you know, other people like Lena Baskett. I did that in 22 hours, I think. And I did The Life of Val Lewton, which, and his career wasn't even that long, and that was 25 hours. And this one is 12 hours 40 so far. And I'm just, literally, he's just arrived in Hollywood.
I'm just very impressed at how you take the time to mention the exact things that they had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner on each day. That's
Well, you're welcome. It involves a time machine. Yeah.
About a week after the Cary Grant episode came out, I was really tempted to tweet you and say, so where's the next one? But I decided against it.
Thank you. I have seven more
parts. I wanted you to come on my show, so I wasn't going to do that.
Bless your soul. I have to say, thank you very much. You've been a very sort of vocal supporter. I do hear from time to time where you've mentioned me and supported me, and thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you finally on a show.
Yeah, and like you, I'm an old-time radio fan, and there are kind of two ways of doing old-time radio. One is just dumping those shows into a feed, which I've done myself, and which a lot of other people have done. And then there's what you do, where you incorporate it into a larger show. Sometimes it's a review. Sometimes it's an old-time radio version of a movie that you've talked about. And so I've enjoyed that aspect. And also, your dog is on the show. I like that, too.
Ooh.
You'll have to listen to understand what role he plays.
It'll sound appalling if I am. It's a she
no,
as well.
I wasn't going to make you do the dog impression. But just right. Listen to Attaboy Clarence. You'll
the dog's a she well, as well. And one of the complaints I had once.
No, I apologize.
No. Well, the thing is, right, this is the funny part. So obviously I'm a man and I'm pretending to be a dog. And we have conversations in the show. It's not as bad as it sounds, by the way.
This just shot to the top of my must listen list.
Right? Yeah, you're selling it.
She's not on it all the time, but I do get emails from time to time from people saying, if your dog's a girl, why does she have a male voice? And I think to myself, that's really why you're emailing me? Can you not tell it's not really a talking dog?
I did not write that email.
It was Shelby Risbin. He wrote it.
Right. That's yeah. Shh. Don't tell people those things. So I wanted to talk to Adam, and I wanted to talk about a Cary Grant movie. And so Adam and I went back and forth about a few movies. And most of my choices, I should say, I didn't even intend to do this, but most of my original thoughts were like really super depressing dramas. And I'm not even sure how I came up with it. And so Adam kindly said, why don't we talk about Hot Saturday? It's pre-code. It's fun. And I, having thought about it, agree completely that we shouldn't have talked about the Cary Grant has made some just incredibly down dramas, which are quite good, but
I know, right? It's like, I watched, I've never seen Number the Lonely Heart until a few months ago. Oh my God. I want to kill myself.
I know, right?
Penny Serenade.
Penny Serenade, dear Lord. My husband loves that movie. I can't watch it.
I mean, I like the film. It definitely gets to my heart, but yeah, it's a tough
one.
I liked it
so much, I bought it on DVD, and you know what? I have never watched that DVD because I can't bring myself to do that to me again.
You have to be in
I've
a dark
like
place
twice,
to want to watch that
But
film.
I can't do it. I can't do it. So, but that's not what we're watching today. So Hot Saturday, 1932... directed by someone called William Sider. I don't know much about him. Starring Cary Grant and Nancy Carroll and Randolph Scott and Edward Woods. Nancy Carroll was by far the biggest star amongst these people at the time. Cary Grant was just sort of beginning his career, and I'll throw it to Adam for some more about that. But it is also the pairing between Cary Grant and Randolph Scott as co-stars in this movie, which I guess began their friendship and subsequent all sorts of rumors about what their relationship might or might not have been. But suffice it to say, they were pals. They don't have a scene together in this movie, except maybe one, which is kind of interesting. It falls definitely in the pre-code period, and we can talk about how it pre-code it is and why. Made by Paramount, where Cary Grant was just getting his feet wet as a star at Paramount. And I didn't know this, and I actually kind of got a prompt from Adam's podcast about it, that there was really kind of a competition between Cary Grant and Gary Cooper at this time on the Paramount lot. So what am I missing, Adam? What do we need to know about Hot Saturday just to place it in time?
For the first movie that Cary Grant was given top billing on, Nancy Carroll was a big star. You're right. I think B.P. Schulberg at the time was trying to placate Cary Grant quite a lot, because basically Gary Cooper had gone off in a huff and said, you're working me too hard. I don't like my workload. I don't like the films I'm being thrown. So he kind of gave himself a self-imposed exile, went off to France, started romancing a married French baroness, went hunting in Africa, and Paramount were really angry with him. And basically, at the time, if a star decided to put their foot down in any way, they were shown the back of the studio's hand. You know, the studio was saying, right, well, we'll show you. And that's how Robert Taylor became famous. You know, Robert Montgomery was playing MGM up, so they brought Robert Taylor in and changed his name to Robert, just to rub salt in the wounds. And so that's what they did with Gary Cooper. They were looking for someone who was very good looking, who was quite charismatic, someone that they could mold into the next sort of romantic, burly, women love him, men want to be him kind of star. And so they brought Cary Grant in, gave him the GC initials to rub that salt in the wound even further. And he'd been working his way through a lot of Gary Cooper rejects at the time, and had slowly worked his way up to into the affections almost of B.P. Schulberg. And Schulberg said, you know, Gary Cooper's turned this film down now, Hot Saturday. We want you to play the lead. So they gave him his first leading role. So, and it's, for me, this is one of the films that I hadn't seen before I started making this show I made. And the early ones are kind of very, very rough. You know, This Is the Night is dreadful, dreadful film. And yeah, The Eagle and the Hawk, Devil in the Deep, all these kind of second tier roles for Cary Grant, really. Hot Saturday is kind of the first movie that you really see the Cary Grant you know in a movie. Like, you know, he's kind of suave. He gets the girl. He's good-hearted. You really do root for the guy. And he has this kind of air of upper-class something about him. So that's basically the background behind the making of the film. I wouldn't say it's a pivotal film in anyone's career, but it's interesting for that point alone. It was his first leading role. I think he was getting rather disillusioned with being thrown Gary Cooper's cast-offs. So B.P. Schulberg said, "No, you know, we'll give you top billing on this." And I think he was having kind of a rough time personally as well. He'd arrived in Hollywood, wasn't making friends very easily, and was feeling rather lonely. And it's the film on which he met and befriended Randolph Scott too. So it's kind of important in terms of the Cary Grant story, even though the film itself is not the greatest film of all time. But when I saw it, I just thought, you know, that's the Cary Grant I know. I've been watching all these early roles like Singapore Sue and, you know, This Is the Night. And when I saw this, I was like, no, that's Cary Grant. That's him. I can see him now. And I just kind of dug it. I just thought it was a good, fun movie. Had a good, you know, a good pre-code sensibility to it. And it's just a good, fun movie.
You know, I wonder if my opinion of it would have been slightly different if I would have watched it sort of in sequence the way that you did, Adam, because that's fascinating that you were watching these older ones where it's, you know, the rough around the edges Cary Grant that's not really our Cary Grant, and you got to this. Mm. So it sounds like it was a bit of a relief to be like, yes,
finally
we're here. Whereas for me, I mean, I haven't seen all of Cary Grant's pictures, or probably even half of them. But I've seen a bunch, and most of them, of course, have been the later ones. And I was coming to this kind of from the other direction, like, oh, it'll be interesting as an archaeological expedition to see a film from him that's this early. And I did appreciate him. I think he did, to me, feel like Cary Grant in this film. So I'm on board there. But pretty much the rest of the movie was like, oh, yikes. Wow, this is a thing I'm getting through. And there were moments that I quite enjoyed, and I didn't think it was all bad, and I'm super glad that I watched it. So I'm very pleased to be on this episode. But I didn't find the whole movie itself to be quite as delightful. And I think maybe if I had done it the other way around, maybe I would have liked it better.
See, I don't know. I mean, you can clearly tell this is a point where they are still learning how to make movies as we understand them, especially sound movies. The sound mixing is weird to non-existent. You know, the middle of the movie drags. It's overly melodramatic. So I wouldn't call it a good movie, but I would call it an amazing movie because I haven't seen a lot of pre-codes and there are things in this movie that just blew my mind. It is it is a weirdly leering and pervy movie in a way that I did not expect. It's like this is the 1930s equivalent of a Skinamax film. I haven't seen any filmed entertainment taking this much interest in women in their underwear since like anime. And yet it's also a weirdly progressive movie in a lot of ways. It has unusually interesting and positive attitudes toward sex, toward minorities. It's really, I was not expecting this. And I loved seeing baby Cary Grant, even in places where like they clearly did not know how to put makeup on a human face. And poor Cary Grant suffered from that.
The last early Cary Grant movies I had seen do predate this. And so when I watched this again, I'd seen it before, but it had been a really long time. And I had the same reaction you did, Adam, that it's very much, oh yeah, this is Cary Grant. He seems comfortable in his skin, even in the Mae West movie that kind of made him a star or gave him the attention that from Paramount. He's really different and more awkward, which is kind of the role he's playing there. But this movie, he's in his own skin in a good way. The other thing I'd say is if I play a game because I watch a lot of old movies, and if I see an old movie that I haven't seen before or that for some reason I don't know exactly when it was made, I try to guess what year it was made, and I give myself 2 years on either side, and I'm usually pretty good at it. And had I not known what year this was made, I probably would have said 1930 or 31 because it feels older than 1932, and 1 year doesn't sound like much, but remember that we're just getting into the sound era. They are just learning to make movies, and it feels like Warner Brothers and MGM were maybe a little further along, or maybe this because this was a B picture and not an A picture from Paramount, it just doesn't feel as well made as other movies of the time.
I totally agree with that,
Yeah, there's no artistry or craft to this movie whatsoever. Well, maybe some of the set design. I like that dance palace with the pretend tree in the middle of the room. And there's that nice shot of the dancer's legs moving back and forth, although I don't know what of that was artistry and what of that was prurience. But yeah, otherwise, no, this is not a artfully made film in really any sense of the word.
So just to set the scene a little bit, we're in a small town called Marysville, and Nancy Carroll is playing Ruth, who is a bank clerk, and in the noisiest, echoiest bank ever, especially for a town of that size. And that's a thing. Like, I've seen several movies of this era where, you know, banks back then had marble and wood, and they were sort of big edifices. But the thing they have in movies almost always are big echoes. American Madness is like that. I don't know why, but they always made bank interiors super echoey.
Yeah.
So Ruth is a bank clerk. There are a lot of very, whether they're horny or whether they're just bored, there are a lot of very young people who have quite a social life in the town.
Why not both?
Yes, they can certainly be both. And Ruth seems to have, you know, her selection of people who are interested in her. And I think her attitude toward that whole thing is rather interesting because she's already decided, I'm not going to pick. I don't have a one sweetheart. And the idea that I should have one is kind of annoying to me.
Well, because the guys she has to choose from are scraping the bottom of the barrel. The guy she ends up with has like a weasel face and a weasel voice. And then the other guy she has to choose from has the approximate intelligence of a pile of bricks.
And yet Cary Grant visits her at the bank very often in the first sort of act and is clearly interested, has all the money in the world, is the most good-looking guy. I think the reason she doesn't go with him, though, is because he has a girlfriend at the time, right? Camille.
Right. Who's out in the car.
Yeah,
and then she sees the
check. She
knows
what he's doing.
And also as well, I mean, there's an air of scandal around his character at the beginning, isn't there? There's, you know, because she's, Camille is clearly living at his, I want to call it a mansion, but it's kind of like a beach housey kind of deal, isn't it? It's very nice.
Right. It seems like a party palace that he's living. I mean, he's right on the water and he, as we'll find out later, I mean, it's perfect for throwing parties. He's got a lot of liquor at his disposal.
Has servants on hand. Yeah. So the whole town are kind of up in arms about the fact that he's so brazen about the fact that he's not married, living in sin with his girlfriend. That's why Nancy sort of holds herself back at the beginning. Sorry, Ruth holds herself back at the beginning.
And I like that when Camille gets fed up with him obviously flirting with someone else while she's waiting in the car and can see him doing so through the window, and she, like, takes off, he's not mad. He's not bad-mouthing her. He writes her a very large and generous check for her time and efforts, and then is just like, well, I hope she had a good time, and I wish her well. And that's lovely. He's not, like, being mean or getting down on her. He's just like, we knew what this was, and I respect you, and I appreciate your time, and we'll compensate you for it, and have a nice life.
I think it's really interesting, actually, because when the film starts and you hear the townsfolk talking about his character, Roma, you do have, like, this preconception installed, either subconsciously or not, by what they're saying. So when he turns up in his flash car and his girlfriend, and she's, like, you know, sneering at everyone, and he's sort of, you know, lances into the bank and starts draping himself over Ruth, you do kind of think, oh, I don't know if I'm going to like this guy. But the more you learn about him, the more you realize that's not the story at all. And it's kind of a wise film in that way. You know, it's got a lot to say about the power of gossip and small town nosy parkers and how they can influence the way people think about people. I did kind of dig that theme quite a lot, actually, especially towards the second, third act.
I think that was my favorite part of the film, was just the idea of, because, I mean, I grew up in a pretty small town, and it was not as gossipy as this, but it was, you know, there was a feeling of that as well. And I like the idea that it seems like at the beginning, I was, you know, fooled into sort of being on the side of the townspeople, like you said, because I was, like, drawn in by this, the idea of him, Romer, being such a cad and a playboy. And he does come up, and, like, yeah, his car is, I've never actually seen a car like that where you have to lift the, like, tray off of you in order to, like, climb yeah. out the side of it. That was new to me. And I was like, wow, that's a really fancy car. You need help to get out of it. And he is totally flirting when there's a girl sitting outside. But as the film goes on, it really punctures that vision that I had of him at the beginning, and honestly makes the townspeople the villains, and just the gossip itself is the villain in this film. And I like that idea.
It's kind of brave in that respect, yeah.
Just as an aside about cars, there's a conversation about roadsters versus closed cars, and closed cars are associated with immorality, I guess, because you can do more in a closed car without being seen. And I hadn't ever really thought about that. And there are a lot of roadsters in movies of this era, but you did have cars with roofs on them at this point, as we'll see later on. But
and yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the people who are doing the gossiping, including the young lady who is, for some reason, jealous that Ruth gets to go out with the worst weasel-faced guy in town and that she has to settle for the pile of bricks. She's spreading all the nastiest gossip, and yet she's doing things in a closed car that are not a game of canasta.
100%. You're right. It's not as if she's losing out on a man to Ruth. I mean, the guys want Ruth, but she's got a boyfriend. She's hanging out with that guy.
I do admire that about this film. Definitely, it sort of skewers this picture that everyone had of the ideal sort of small town Americana kind of picture, you know. And it's just a nest of vipers, really.
The thing you have to say about Cary Grant's methodology here, though, is so clearly he wants Ruth, and his method for getting her attention is, I'm going to have a big party, I'm going to invite you and all your friends, and I'm going to provide all the liquor you could possibly want. And I think the first time I saw this movie, all of these people are playing older than they are. Cary Grant's close to 30, so is Nancy Carroll, but the impression that's left with me is that most of these people are playing early 20s. And I thought, I don't know why, because Cary Grant doesn't look considerably older than they do, but maybe because he's wealthy and he has his own money, he gives the impression of being somewhat older. And so I had that sort of sense of the guy who's going back to the high school party and throwing a big party so that the young people will hang out with him. Uh-huh. And hey, I've got liquor, it's still prohibition. And clearly he's throwing this party so that he can get close to Ruth, because Ruth, although it's clear she likes him, has not come across either in terms of going out with him or anything else. And so he's like, I know, I'll throw a giant party and I'm going to be super transactional about it. Come over to my beach house and have all the booze you want.
Mm-hmm. And yet, And yet, when they get to the party, does he ply Ruth with booze and try to get her, like, in a room? No. Nope. He asks her to go on a walk, and they take a nice walk. He's not trying to get her drunk. He does make a few passes at her, and when she tells him, hey, knock it off, he says, I respect you and will immediately knock it off, and does.
He doesn't pin her down like Weaselface does.
Yeah. It's sort of at this point in the film that you have your expectations upended by everyone, really.
And speaking of expectations upended, there's a scene at the party where Cary Grant's, I want to say butler, and I'm guessing the character is meant to be Filipino-American. He's pushing a tray of, I believe it said tamales and lemonade, which I love, through the party. But the camera stays on him. The focus is not on this is a servant, an object catering to the white characters. No, the sympathy is, look at this poor guy working hard in a crowd full of dum-dums. And then, like, when Pile of Bricks says some horrible racist thing to him in Pidgin English, he gets a chance to respond back in perfect, flawless British accented English, you know, and make Pile of Bricks look like the moron that he is. And I love that the movie took time to do that and treat this guy like a human being rather than some dumb stereotype.
Totally.
Yes, absolutely.
I will say for the party scene, though, I appreciated that Cary Grant backed off and, you know, didn't pin her down like Weaselface did, but they continued to go on their walk, and then the camera cuts away to what everybody else is doing at the party. And I felt like the movie, as we're talking about it, they're still kind of learning how to make movies. I felt like they didn't really effectively give me the shorthand to know for sure that she hadn't done anything with him while the camera was away from them. So I actually found myself, like, until we got to the part where she is saying, no, I really didn't do anything, I was kind of wondering, has she actually just, like, gone off and had a fling with him in the middle of the woods and they didn't tell us? So I feel like that was just a little bit of a shortcoming in terms of the filmmaking to not hammer that home quite well enough for me to know until that character told us, and I believed that character later on in the film. I was kind of like, maybe the townspeople are being, you know, mean and bitchy about it, but maybe they're actually saying something that really happened. But no, that was totally not the case.
That's a fair comment, I think, definitely. Yeah.
And I think back to the drinking and stuff, which I'm just fascinated by, because it's not mentioned once. It's mentioned four or five times. Then there's that later scene where the guy is just, like, pouring quarts of booze to take away with him. I don't think that Cary Grant got all that booze to get Ruth drunk. I think he got it to get her friends drunk so that they would be distracted and he could spend time with her.
Yep.
Yeah. Not clearly a bad plan. I do love the scene where she's I think she's, like, using his phone or something. She's upstairs in his house and she knows that he's going to come in and find her. So she's, like, lying down in a settee, and then she suddenly adjusts her skirt just a little bit higher just to make sure that when he comes in, even though she's going to rebuff him, he gets the good view.
Oh, yeah. I have done that. Like, not the pulling the skirt higher, but I have done the, like, okay, he's going to be coming into this room. How can I pose myself so that I will look as beautiful as possible to the person coming through the door? Like, that moment felt really, really real to me.
I think we've all hitched our skirts up.
Yeah, she's not playing the innocent who is being mistreated by all manner of men in all manner of different ways. She has some agency about what she's doing, and that's clear at this point, as it is even earlier when she is not accepting all, you know, the offer of the sleazebag who, you know, she's pretty well aware of who's a good match for her and who probably isn't, and who wants something she's not interested in giving them.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the younger sister?
Yes, please. Let's do that.
She's hilarious.
She
only gets a couple of scenes, but she's hysterical.
But I feel like she's acting in a slightly different movie than everybody else is.
That's what makes her so funny.
I kind of got the feeling she was going to be a bigger piece of the film, with the whole clothing thing at the beginning. I thought that was kind of an omen of something that was going to happen later on.
I wonder if they cut some of her scenes. I like the later scene when she's talking to the coat that belongs to the boy to the Randolph Scott's character.
But also,
I may have done that too.
This is basically an autobiography, isn't it?
Kind of, yes.
In a modern movie, you would never have a scene where an older sister throws her younger sister down on the bed, lifts up her skirt, and drags off the shorts she is wearing in full view of the camera, while the camera just sits back and takes it in. I don't know what was going on there, but it was not savory.
Pre-code,
people.
But that would happen in real life. I may
for sure. Yeah. I've not done that. I will say that. I've never done that to my sister.
I haven't done that, but I have a younger sister who might have taken something that didn't belong to her that I wanted back rather badly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree that it felt true to life as sisters, but I'm also like, should I be seeing this? Am I going to jail now?
So while we're at the house, let's talk about Ruth's family. So she has a father and a mother as well as a sister. The first time we see the mother and father, each of them puts a touch on Ruth because Ruth has a job. Dad apparently does not. I don't know what his circumstances are, but the mother is the shrewish, terrible taskmaster, and the dad wants money for cigars.
Because he goes around like giving out the cigars, and people keep referring to him as, is it senator?
Yeah, he's a senator, but apparently a broke one.
Is he? I mean, maybe he's an ex-senator and they still call him
that. That's
what
I don't get, because he doesn't give the impression that he is an actual senator, except when he's outside handing the cigars out. I don't know. It's
I kind of thought he was an ex-senator who was used to the high life. That's why he wants cigars or something, maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Either that or because this is small town America, and small town America can sometimes be quirky and weird. It's just like a nickname that they have given him because he's the kind of guy that glad hands everybody and hands out cigars and that sort of thing. So they just call him senator he's the kind of guy that they would like to be their senator. However, the movie never really tells us that. So that was kind of another gap that I was like, well, I feel like I'm missing some important information that I need about this fellow here, but they never give it to us.
But I do like the relationship between the father and the mother. They are clearly very affectionate, and, you know, she might badger and nag, but, you know, when the two of them get together, when Randolph Scott's character shows up and are kind of happily commiserating and plotting about hitching him up to their daughter, it is kind of sweet.
Yeah.
She's terrible to her daughter, though. I think their relationship is interesting, and he is also close to his daughter. He never at any point says to his wife, "Ease up." Well, maybe a couple of times, but not really. Like, because Jane Darwell as the mother just really rips into her daughter and basically, you know, make a good marriage, bring home more money, and then when you can, make a good marriage, and you should marry the Randolph Scott character when he shows up. But also, your questionable behavior is causing gossip that is, you know, affecting me in some way. And then eventually she loses her job and Jane Darwell gets to say, see, see. And all of this is set up for when Ruth leaves later in the movie. She's not going to be leaving much in terms of a family relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It's a bit caustic there, but it's delivered in sort of subtle doses. I kind of like that too. You kind of get the feeling that they're just like a crazy knockabout family to begin with, and you know they're a bit broke and all this kind of thing. But the more it goes on, that you feel the deeper rifts, don't you? And they sort of show themselves as the movie goes on.
Yeah, at the beginning, it's not so bad. You're right, and it really escalates once the party is over and she's come home, and when the Randolph Scott character comes in as a potential match for her, then it's all really serious, because whatever Ruth is doing is going to prevent her from being with Randolph Scott, who for some reason we're told he's wealthy, although I guess he's a working geologist. He's going to camp up in the mountains, and so
he works for an oil company, right? The guy's fine. Like, he's doing all right, I'm sure.
Fair point.
I think it was interesting that she is the breadwinner for this family.
Right.
And she gets, like, just, you know, the short end of the stick in terms of the family dynamics. I mean, maybe it's not quite as bad as the little sister, but yeah, she is very much relied upon to keep food on the table and cigars in dad's pocket. And also, she's supposed to be ladylike and not get up to anything that's going to shame them. And I found it kind of interesting because it seems like later films and, you know, later society sort of backtracked a little bit on the women working outside the home as being an okay thing to do. In this movie, it seems like it's perfectly fine for her to be a working lady who is earning a paycheck, and they love that paycheck, and nobody is shaming her for that in any way, shape, or form. But eventually, she's supposed to get married and not have to worry about working anymore. But I feel like there is, later on, even doing any kind of work, rather than just going out and getting a man, seemed like that was not the way to go. So that was another sort of moment of like this film feeling progressive to me in a way that I wasn't expecting for a movie that was this old. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. And they're very parasitical. I mean, every member of the family in some way is taking from Ruth. The little sister's stealing her clothes. The mom is on her back for money. The dad is always hitting her up for spare change. You know, it's really interesting because you get the sense that, like, the whole town in one way or another is feeding off Ruth. Either they're mining her for gossip and, you know, entertainment for themselves, or they're taking her money. And it's interesting that Cary Grant is the one guy, I mean, he wants something from her, but he's not going to take it. He's just out there. He's put himself out there and he said, hi, how you doing? I like you. If you want to be with me, great. I'm not going to force the issue and I'm not going to ask anything else of you.
And the thing that he wants from her is literally, it's her to be herself, to be her own woman, whereas everybody else wants her to be something that she is, to be a certain way that they think that she should be. Whereas Cary Grant's character, Romer's the only one that actually just wants her to be herself and be relaxed, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, he genuinely admires her, which is lovely.
Mm-hmm. He wants from her something that she will be prepared to give. Like, as you say, he's not taking. And I think it's funny when they first go on that walk and he sort of gives her the sweet talk and talks about her hair and all of that stuff. The script is not great in general, but there are little gems in it. And what I like is there's a point during that conversation where, and later we'll see it again, where he kind of gets hip to the fact that he's giving her a line, and he realizes himself, oh, this is somebody I want to have a different kind or more of a relationship with. I want the same thing I wanted from before and from any girlfriend I've had, but I also kind of want this thing to last. And he kind of hears himself say these things about her beauty, and he's like, oh, I need to find a way to communicate. You know, there's the part later, and I think it's in a different conversation where he's like, you have a mind, and that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure what to do with that.
Yeah, certainly.
And I do love, though, that he is just the kind of dude who can be chilling in his culturally appropriated kimono on the front steps of his beach house in the middle of the night, just chilling with a bottle of whiskey. And he's cool. He doesn't need to be chasing anybody. He's just happy to be where he is.
I want that life.
Mm-hmm. And he knows exactly how to handle the situation when a girl just runs up and hiding out. Help.
Totally.
Kind of just tightens
and
the belt.
And then he's, you know, she's going to hide in a little bit and he's going to be okay with that. And he's going to, you know, clock the guy who comes after her once. And the guy's going to go, oh, okay. And Cary Grant has never broken a sweat the whole time.
Does Cary Grant ever break a sweat?
He's Cary Grant. That's right.
Right. He wouldn't.
Only on purpose.
Yeah.
So, Adam, I wanted to ask about Cary Grant and Randolph Scott, because I have, for years, I have heard the stories about Cary Grant and Randolph Scott. I have heard things about photo shoots for, I think, maybe Life magazine, where they wear matching pink aprons. So what is the story with Cary Grant and Randolph Scott? Were they just good buddies, or were they super good buddies?
It's very interesting. So when I first announced that I was doing this series, people tend to know that I really do a lot of research and tend to tell the entire story, but I don't tend to speculate very often. I just give the facts and then people can make their own minds up. With Cary Grant and Randolph Scott, with Cary Grant in particular, the first question anyone's ever asked me, they always ask is, so was he gay? It's like, I'll look into it and see what I can find, you know. But there have been some people who work for the press and they knew this series was coming and they were like, we'd like to talk to you, especially about his sexuality. And quite honestly, I can't find any evidence that he was or wasn't gay, bisexual, or, you know. I think he definitely had very close friendships with gay men. The evidence suggests that he might well have had sexual relationships with them, but I'm reluctant to say he was or wasn't anything, really. I think the point I make in this series, I do actually address this issue in a much more expansive reasoned way, is that I don't think it really matters at the end of the day. I think he was a very private person who presented as much as he wanted to present to the world. I think when it comes to the whole Randolph Scott thing, he lived with Randolph Scott for sure. And he may, you know, it may well have been romantic feelings there. But the image he put out into the world was very controlled and very crafted. And I think he had fun with those kinds of photos, and he didn't mind people speculating. But he said repeatedly, you know, the real me is, you know, private, and you'll never know a very large, significant portion of myself. It's mine, and I want to keep it that way.
That's true.
Yeah. So I think I'm not deflecting your question. I honestly don't know if he was or wasn't. I personally would say he may well have dabbled, but I think he was very careful about the information he put out. And the point I'm making in the show is that I think gay speculation around sexuality was very not important, but almost courted by some stars during the golden age. It kind of helped their press appeal in a way. I think with Cary Grant and Randolph Scott, I think they kind of played with that a lot, and they were very, very close friends. But the evidence would suggest that it's been blown out of proportion. That's all I can really say. I mean, I've read a biography which purports to be the definitive take on his sexuality. And it states things like, you know, Randolph Scott and Virginia Cheryl, who was Grant's first wife, were at loggerheads throughout, you know, their time together because they were fighting over Cary Grant. And if you take that account as gospel, you go, well, it's definitely he was gay then. But then Virginia Cheryl herself, who had no skin in the game really in later life, could have well confirmed or denied, but you know, confirmed that story, stated that it was all rubbish. She got on great with Randolph Scott, and Cary Grant was most certainly not gay. All of his wives say that he was most certainly not. And I think if you take the evidence and remove the speculation, it doesn't look like he was, but maybe he did. I it's a very confusing, very long answer. I do apologize, but
no, that's fine. I mean, I know
there's so much information out. You can kind of plant your flag in the sand one way or the other, I think.
I mean, his ambiguity is I think part of his charm and his appeal. And I do know that later in life he was a tremendously devoted and doting father. Because I've heard an interview with his daughter talking about just what a wonderful dad he was and how completely devoted to her he was.
The thing that I also learned from what you said in your documentary, Adam, is about his relationship with the press. I had never really thought about it or considered it, but he, as you say, he kind of played with them. He didn't like the studio manipulating, as they would do with any star who would allow them to do that. And he seems like he played with them when he had to deal with them, but he would really just rather not. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, he was ordered. I mean, he met Randolph Scott on this film. They became superb friends. They were kind of the yin and yang of each other, but they supplemented each other in amazing ways. Like, you know, Cary Grant was not that extroverted, and Randolph Scott was. Cary Grant was far more, you know, culturally educated, and Randolph Scott wasn't. So they both sort of fed off each other. Cary Grant, you know, picked clothes out for Randolph Scott, you know, and Randolph Scott took him to clubs and introduced him to people and, you know, gave him a good time, basically, and brought him out of himself. So I think they definitely had this relationship where it rescued Cary Grant in a way. I think he was quite low at that before he'd met Randolph Scott, and it kind of reaffirmed that he wanted to be in Hollywood, and it was okay, and he had a friend now and a partner. So I think in terms of importance, that's why this film is important, I think.
It's interesting to me because Randolph Scott barely registers in this movie. Part of that is just that Cary Grant is at full wattage and is blowing everybody else off the screen in terms of charisma. But Randolph Scott is kind of a drip in this film. He does have some nice chemistry with Nancy Carroll. But otherwise, yeah, he's not really – I didn't look at him and go, now there's a movie star.
I think he's pretty. I don't know that Randolph Scott was ever perceived as a great actor. And, of course, he famously did an awful lot of – Westerns, which require a different sort of acting. But I, seeing this movie and not even capable of bringing to mind another specific Randolph Scott performance, my take was he's new to this. Mm-hmm. And he acts like a lot of sort of young leading men in 1932 who were given the boyfriend part, and there's not any sort of outsized role for him to play other than being initially the boyfriend who's going to save Ruth from this terrible fate of the town's gossiping about her, and ultimately the suitor who feels wronged by that very gossip.
It's interesting that you mention that he's in a lot of Westerns, because I feel like this casting is sort of the aw shucks wholesome fellow, sort of falls a little bit more toward the Western stereotypical hero. Then, you know, I feel like it was a fine casting in terms of, on the one hand, you've got this wholesome fellow, and then on the other hand, you have Cary Grant. And I think that it really showed you both sides of, like, a choice that, you know, she's got to make. And so, and maybe his performance wasn't, like, high wattage like Cary Grant's, but I think it wasn't supposed to be. So I feel like maybe they succeeded on that front in terms of, you know, this is a guy who is wholesome but kind of a drip. And on the other hand, Cary Grant in his flashy car.
And it's interesting that, you know, when push comes to shove, Randolph Scott's character is supposed to be the stand-up guy, but he gets jealous and believes the gossip and pushes Ruth away and loses out for it. I thought that was an interesting subversion. You expect his character to be the White Knight who comes in and saves her from ruin and ignominy, or however you pronounce that. But he doesn't. He's just as bad as everybody else. Well, almost as bad. He eventually realizes that he made a mistake, but he realizes too late. And I thought that was interesting about this film.
I think, Erica, when you said about the film's shorthand, you know, left you wanting at points. Mm-hmm. That's probably my biggest issue with this film, is Randolph Scott's character, Bill. It's kind of like he shows up too late to matter. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. By then we're already far too deep in with the other characters, and all of a sudden he sort of strides in, hi, by the way, I'm, you know, the guy Ruth used to be in love with. And you kind of like, oh, hang on, there's not enough, there wasn't enough signaling that he was in the story or coming or anything. So I did find that was a bit sort of, I find his character, I do have problems with him.
They build him up earlier in the story. They're like, hey, you remember that handsome guy, Bill, that you were totally in love with? But when Randolph Scott shows up, you're like, him?
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That guy? And as we've mentioned before, the younger sister is sort of in love with him as an ideal, too. So and Ruth, seeing him as a way out, I don't know that she's in love. Well, she loved him at some point. And whether she loves him now, it's unclear, because she's trapped by this gossip and she goes to find him on a dark and stormy night and ends up at his camp, and he undresses her and wraps her in a robe and, you know, dries her out and stuff, which creates an intimate moment between them. And then they get engaged because it's kind of her idea. And he's like, okay, let's get engaged. And the interesting thing to me about when he turns and when he hears the gossip and he rejects her, he's hearing the gossip from the friends of hers who are trying to help her, because there's Eva, the sort of leader of the gossip, and there's it's all over town. But what he actually overhears is, oh, it really is really crummy what's happening to Ruth. I wonder if there's any way we can help out. And he hears that, and he doesn't, you know, go confront Ruth or find out whether it's true. He's basically just like, yeah, I'm done with you. And it doesn't hurt that Cary Grant is right there. So he sees his rival and he's like, oh, well, all right, I guess it's all true.
I remember when I first watched this film, that I looked at the running time when that scene happened, and it had like 4 minutes to go. And I was thinking, wow, they've got a lot to do. You know, you can tell there's some kind of conflict coming. But of course, in old Hollywood style, they manage it.
And it's pretty rich of him to get upset. I mean, he's like, how dare you also have unspecified possible relations with the woman who's under things I have not only seen but removed personally while she was unconscious, you know.
Good old Bill.
Let's talk about how it's resolved. So she basically tells the Randolph Scott character, Bill, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to accept your apology, which comes the next day. She's been out all night. Her parents are wringing their hands. And this is a point where I think you kind of see them sort of together on, I don't know what's up with Ruth, but something's up with Ruth. And she comes home the next morning, and Bill comes by to apologize. She says, you know that terrible stuff that you thought about me and Cary Grant, but me and Romer before, it wasn't true then. It's true now.
Bum, bum, bum.
And this is when I wish I had like some air horns to sound off, that sound effect. Because yeah. that blew my mind. She sails out of the movie with the 1932 equivalent of both middle fingers raised while the town burns behind her. It is just astounding.
Because Romer is waiting outside for her. His car is running. Clearly, she's just come home either to say goodbye or grab her bag or whatever it is. And they drive off into the sunset toward New York in a roadster.
At which point, this incredibly wealthy man says, actually, I know you were thinking that I was just going to use you as a bit of fun, but actually, I adore you. Let's get married, and then you can have a share in my millions of dollars.
I felt like it didn't.
I wonder if that was a code thing. I mean, I know there, it's not that there was no code. It's that the code wasn't particularly strenuously enforced, but there still were external entities like the Legion of Decency and various who could get a movie banned from a specific jurisdiction. And so sometimes a studio would change an ending or change some element of the movie because they knew it was going to get banned if they didn't
that
do it.
Really, really did feel like it because, I mean, for me, I felt like the story was done with the two of them just riding off into the future. Like, that was fine. And the fact that, like, he puts that button on it, and I was just like, oh, this wraps it up in, like, too neat of a bow. It's not quite like what I was hoping for. It did feel like it was sort of a tacked on thing. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was a, you know, 11th hour adjustment on somebody's part.
Oh, I'm used to last minute automotive cop outs in Cary Grant films after I saw Hitchcock's Suspicion.
Oh my goodness me. Yeah.
But did anyone else get vibes of The Graduate in that last scene? They're driving away and like you can see the doubt playing out on Ruth's face until he's like, nope, actually I'm gonna marry you and you're gonna be super rich.
Yeah. Totally. I totally see that. I like the ending. I think it's fun.
We've talked about it some, but I guess just overall impressions and how you guys come out on this movie, I'd be interested to hear.
I probably won't watch this movie again. Like I said, I am glad that I did watch it. It felt like a really neat piece of Cary Grant's history that I got to see played out. But it really left me cold in terms of wanting to, like, caring about any of these characters and wanting to watch this story play itself out again. Like, Cary Grant is one of probably my most rewatched classic movie stars. Like, his movies for me are comfort movies, and I will just watch them over and over again. And a lot of that does have to do with Cary Grant being on screen. But I think this is not going to become one of those simply because there is sort of a lot of shorthand, and it does feel like they're trying to get their feet and figure out how to make a movie. And the writing is sort of like thin on the ground in terms of actual character development. There's a lot of headcanoning going on for me to sort of make these characters actually remotely three-dimensional. So I am glad that I watched it, and I was happy to get a chance to talk about it. But I don't think this is one that I'm going to revisit in the future.
Yeah, I have no need to see this movie again, but I am so glad that I saw it. That ending is amazing and left my jaw on the floor. I really enjoyed seeing baby Cary Grant. And if this movie has taught me anything, it's that I need to see more pre-code movies.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's like watch a lot of these films basically because I, you know, have to. I'm talking about the productions going on behind them or who was in it or, you know, where they were in their career at the time. So for me, this was kind of a pleasurable experience. You know, it stood out from the others. You know, when you watch sort of 8 to 10 other movies and you have to watch them because you're researching them, this was one that I just found it was a bit more bouncy than the others, a bit more fun. I really liked the sensibilities it had. I liked what it said about, you know, like you say, it had something to say about racism and small town gossip and sexual attitudes. And I just dug it. I think it's a good example of a pre-code. And I mean, I've seen it 3 times now in the past 3 months, and I'll watch it again. Don't worry, Erica. I'll watch
you can, you take that for me. Thank you.
No problem.
There you go. I've seen a lot of pre-codes, and I love them. My two favorite old movie genres are pre-code and film noir. And so this is, to me, it's a pretty middling pre-code. I did enjoy it more the second. I watched it twice in preparing for this, and so I liked it probably best the second time I watched it, because I kind of knew what to expect, but I was paying closer attention. And so there were small things about interactions between characters that I got on second viewing that I hadn't gotten on the first. And I guess, and part of, you know, what I try to do on this show is encourage people to watch movies that will surprise them. And Nathan, you're a big part of how and why I think about doing that.
Oh, I love it.
This is not a movie that I can hear you saying, will this blow my mind? And my answer would be no. I would not imagine that it would, because there are other precodes that are, for various reasons, and it's not because of their prurience or because of a particular shocking thing. It's just sort of the way they were made and in the context of when they were made, that are just far better movies. They're far better acted. But yeah, this feels like a good bit of Cary Grant history to see. I think the idea that this is where he's really fully formed as a Cary Grant character is worth noting. And if you want to see that, watch one of the earlier ones where he has a supporting role and you'll go, oh, okay, I see. Cary Grant got better. And that's good. I enjoy seeing actors that I like get better.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the reason I dig this film so much is that I kind of see them through a different lens, I think. Then, you know, I don't watch it and go, well, I'm going to be entertained. I watch this and I'm always thinking about the historical context, and I wonder how the conservatives saw this film when it came out. And I think I was just a little bit shocked. And I really liked the song halfway through. Did you, Burning For
Yeah,
You?
Yeah, we didn't talk about the scene in hall with the woman, with the performer. And that was kind of interesting. And, well, that whole scene is interesting because they turn the lights down and then they show the bit with the women's legs.
And
then
they're all singing along to it. I really, really dug that.
And she's sort of like clutching her chest during the song.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is one of those subtle metaphors in 1930s music that's just really hard to pick up on. Something about I think she was singing about the need to better fund municipal fire departments.
Well, of course, else. Duh.
So my spouse Stephen does not enjoy movies from basically before like 1970. That's just not his era. But he has had to sit through a good number of them with me. And one of the things that always just kind of makes him shake his head and laugh is when the movies will just stop and suddenly there's a musical number or a song or something. And I was like, so when this happened, I was like, okay, they may not completely know how to make a movie, but they've got this bit down. Because that is a thing. That is totally a thing.
Yeah. It was a bit of a banger, that song. I've actually been looking for it on vinyl. I think I'm going to be on hard rotation.
Oh, there you go. Well, that would probably fit right in with your show, with Adam Winkler. You could fit that right in there.
I'm on it.
I want to thank all of you guys for joining me, Erica, Nathan, and Adam, for being a first-time guest. Thank you all so much. And now I ask the famous question that I always do at the end of the show, which is, where can we find you online? Erica, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, I do a lot of podcasting here at The Incomparable, so click on my name in the podcast and you will see lots of things. In addition to The Incomparable, probably the thing I'm the most known for is my Doctor Who podcast, Verity. So if you want to hear six women from all across the globe talking about Doctor Who, check out Verity.
Nathan, how about you? We know you're not on social media, but you are around.
I am around. You can hear me on various Incomparable podcasts from time to time, mostly this one, but a few others occasionally. And I've also been contributing short essays to my fellow Incomparable buddy, Kelly Gamont's tinyactivism.net. It is essays that take about 5 minutes to read and are things that you can do in about 5 minutes a day or less that can make the world a better place. They're mostly U.S. politics focused, but things like checking your voter registration, putting your elected representatives on speed dial, things like that.
Very nice. And Adam, we know where you are, but tell us again in case somebody missed it at the beginning.
Well, my main website is attaboyclarence.com, which you can also reach by putting in secrethistoryofhollywood.com. And I'm very active on Patreon, which is patreon.com/attaboysecret. On Twitter, I'm at moviehistories and at attaboyc. And the second part of Cary Grant is coming in the next few months. They take a while to make.
May I quickly plug vote.org? Elections are coming up in the United States on Tuesday, November 3rd. You can go to vote.org to check your voter registration, learn about options for early voting or absentee balloting, and just make sure that you're ready to cast your ballot on November 3rd.
Excellent way to close out the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Ace in the Hole from 1954. Should you wish to watch along with us, that is much more available than Hot Saturday in the streaming world, and there is a link in the show notes. You can follow this show at Lion Tower Shield on Twitter, because there's a character limit, and you can subscribe at theincomparable.com/LTS. Thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.